This is Really Veg Talk, and this is Louis Larron.
Hey, good looking. You got cooking. I'm about cooking something up with me.
I feel good and slightly vulnerable.
It's like fun sitting here.
Oh, do you think so?
Oh.
You're so gorgeous. You're so talented.
Yeah, you're right. Stop talking about it.
That song is the junk.
Sweet baby. You think maybe we could find us a brand new recipe?
Oh. You alright? Everything okay?
The tastiest guest.
Oh, this is weird.
Heartiest banter.
I'm confused.
And the hottest topics.
And the things you're talking about, I was going red.
Radio EduTalk presents Loose Learners. It's never too late to learn on the web.
Yeah, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If you're listening live, welcome to Loose Learners. This is episode one. What and who are the Loose Learners? This is me, John Johnson, and with me is Mariana Funes. Good evening, Mariana.
Good evening, John. Can you hear me okay?
Well, yeah, it sounds okay to me. I hope it's sounding out there. If anybody's listening live, feel free to let us know about the audio quality. And we're using the hashtag #LLLearn, which I've obviously forgotten to use on all the tweets leading up to this. But I'll get better at that over the weeks. So, what we're going to be doing?
What are we going to be doing, John? Yeah, do we know what we're going to be doing?
Yeah, we've got a plan. Both of us spend quite a lot of time on the internet and learning in the sort of widest possible use of the word learning, and we like to talk about stuff about the internet, and that's basically what we're talking about: the internet, the web, learning. Maybe talk about things that are coming up, some issues that affect learning and affect life on the internet, any gossip we find, and all the rest of it. And somebody asked us why we're doing this, and I guess because we can. Mariana and I have been doing a wee bit of podcasting for a few years now on DS106 Radio, and I think we had wrung out all the juice from DS106 that we could, and thought we'd expand our wings and look at learning across the web and other things like that. So we're going to try and do quite a tight show. If you listen to EduTalk or you'd listen to 106 Bullets, I guess they are usually conversational, and just went on as long as they were going to do. But what we're going to try and do is have three sections every month, because we're going to try this once a month to start with. We've got a bunch of different ideas and different categories, but we're going to pull out three every month and try to do about 10 minutes on each of these things, and just take it easy and see where we're going. Nothing's laid down in stone yet. We're just playing with this idea. So do we want to go over the sorts of things we're going to be talking about as a sort of introduction before we get on to the first section of the show, Mariana?
Shall we do that? Shall we kind of just give maybe not all of the headings, but just some ideas of some of the headings that that we were thinking? I guess that under the heading of, education on the web and the two of us learning, there is the kind of behind the scenes idea, all these issues around privacy, what the platforms do or don't, and we're putting that under the heading of "You are the product," which sounds very scary and creepy, but we'll try to make it sensible and useful, hopefully. We also want to look at some ideas around emerging tech, the indie web, etc. How is it useful? And we thought that we'll start with some exploration around what the indie web is and so on. But we want to explore other things. We want to talk about tools. We want to talk about the idea of digital mindfulness and how useful it might or might not be. And I guess generally the kind of open education, connected learning heading, which in some senses can and will be sometimes talking about the S106 as a hashtag classroom if anything is going on. But of course, there are many different hashtag classrooms and events that are going on online. And to the extent that we know about what's going on, and maybe even, you know, as we get going, people let us know what's going on. We can also have, you know, a section at some point talking about here are some of the things that may be coming up. And that's probably enough about the ideas we have about the categories, I guess. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a good overview. Maybe we should just give a sort of 5-6 word what we are, because I'm John Johnson. I'm a primary school teacher in Glasgow in Scotland. And Mariana, I don't know if you can do it in 6 words.
I can. I'm a psychologist. I'm specifically a cognitive psychologist, and I teach in higher education, mostly online at this point.
Brilliant. So we cover quite a range, I guess, from primary education through to tertiary. I think we've got quite a varied set of tools and ideas, so hopefully this will work out quite well.
And I hesitate to say where I'm from, because whilst we are both in the UK, you're in Scotland, I'm in England. When you do online teaching, your students tend to be spread around all over the world. So that is quite an interesting thing about, you know, being based here in the UK. But for example, yesterday, you know, I was talking to, you know, one student in California, and then, you know, later on in the day I was talking to another student in Australia, so I get very confused about my time zones.
Yeah, so I'm living in Glasgow and Mariana's living on the internet. Just moved in lock, stock and barrel.
There you go.
Right, so as I said, we're attempting some organisation, and we're just going to go right into the first section this week, Mariana, which is fallen under the you are the product bit. You want to take us away?
Yes. Well, this we decided to start with this heading, and particularly to start with this article that was published in The Guardian this Sunday, just gone. The title of it is Robert Mercer, the Big Data Billionaire Waging War on Mainstream Media. You sent it through, and I read it, and it ruined my Sunday, as I said to you on Twitter, because it actually covers a very wide range of topics, and it is actually quite long. But we felt that, you know, some of the issues were important enough that we wanted to maybe start to explore this article. And we are very lucky in that we know one of the researchers for this article, Paul Olivier de Haay, who is a mathematician in Switzerland. And because the article was so long, I thought that it might be a nice idea to get him to give us a paragraph to summarize what the key issues in the article are. And then, depending on how we're doing with time, for us to be able to, you know, talk and explore a little about, you know, what interested us about it. So I said to him, can you give me just a one paragraph summary of the article and how it speaks to this idea of you are the product, you know, when you're talking about us in the context of the web? And he said, companies are collecting tons of data about our experience on and offline and our behavior and our behaviors in response. It turns out this collected data can be extremely indicative of intimate psychological traits with predictive power across contexts. When suddenly used in the political domain with a massive influx of money and talent and the amplifying effects of earned media, this can have runaway effects. I asked, when you say runaway effects, because I didn't really understand what that meant, do you mean that, you know, the control of society by private individuals and maybe their ideology, that they are therefore in some sense damaging the democratic system? And he said, well, runaway refers more to losing control, data points are nearly useless at an individual level, but when assembled with tons of other data, money, etc., they can have outsized effect. He talked briefly about an article in TechDirt and other places. I think it got reported. He said a very good case in point is you need to look up the story about this one black voter who was in one of the polling panels and dramatically skewed the predicting throughout the whole election because he was going to vote Republican. I guess it's the amplification of, you know, something, one thing that is unusual, and then it can become main, you know, it just distorts things. So, I mean, I think, you know, Paul Olivier has been working on this for a long time. Some people define him as a data activist, which I thought, ooh, that must be quite nice to be a data activist. Mm. He's doing a lot of, really, he's writing quite a lot and doing a lot of research around, you know, really to help all of us understand some of the issues in something that actually is quite complex and often, you know, quite difficult to get hold of. Because often what happens, and it did happen on Twitter as a result of this article, what happens is that you get this whole thing around, you know, conspiracy theories. Oh, it can't be true. Oh, it must be not right. Because, of course, there are, you know, it's all kind of intangible. You can't grab hold of it. So people refuse to believe it's true. Mm. And it is quite, I think, a very interesting dynamic that we refuse to accept that it could possibly be us who might possibly be influenced by people manipulating media and the web. So there we are. What scared you about it?
Well, I've been kind of reading this for a while, I guess. Probably the end of last year, I started reading various bits about mainly Facebook and to do with the fake news stuff that was going there, but the interface of Facebook and how it works. And then there was a bit about a Cambridge scientist who had done all this work analysing people's personalities. And there's two characters from Cambridge involved, neither of whose name I, of course, can remember. But the first one basically did a whole lot of work, and he got to the point where from a very few bits of data, I think it was about 60 or 70 likes, he could tell an awful lot about you. He could tell your race, he could tell your sexuality with, I think that was about 80% certainty, and they could do, you know, a whole range of other stuff. And that work was then picked up by another guy who seems to have turned the research into a sort of commercial organisation, which I think is called Cambridge Analytics. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be claiming at the moment, at least, that they did a lot of work for the Republicans in the election in America. And also the article that was in the Observer Guardian on Sunday there was about the fact that the same people who paid for that also seemed to give the services, didn't sell the services, they gave the services to the Brexit folk. So
that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Because they could claim that they weren't officially working for them.
Yeah. I've seen other things, and we'll pop a few links in the show notes, and some people are saying it's just a claim by Cambridge Analytics and the Republicans are denying it and things like that. But the idea seems very doable when you see what they did. And what they seem to do is use all this data they're getting on people to then decide who they're showing what sort of advert. And they seem to actually, with the software, be running out like thousands and thousands of adverts that are slightly different on Facebook and showing them to people so that those people will be most affected by that particular advert. So, you know, if I was somebody who wasn't, if I was against, say, voter that was on the cusp, but I wasn't worried, or the type of person that wouldn't be worried about email scandals, then they wouldn't have shown me that sort of anti-Clinton advert. But if I was worried about something else, they might have run some of the stuff that hinted about the paedophile ring or something in the pizza place. That's, I'm not saying that's exactly what they were doing, but they use it so that they can customise on a vast scale adverts, and they're putting out hundreds of thousands of these things over the election. So I think that was quite scary.
The name of the guy that you were talking about is Michael Kosinski, and the quote that you were referring to, I found it here. He said his claim, let's just put it that way, his claim is that 150 likes, their model could predict someone's personality better than their spouse. With 300, it understood you better than yourself. Yeah. Computers see us in a more robust way than we see ourselves, says Kosinski. So, it's a psychometric model, I guess, that uses your clicks. Click, click, click.
Well, this whole, for a start, they bought huge amounts of data from Facebook, I think. And what is really scary is the stuff that the browser knows about you. And that's where the click, click, click dot click comes in. If you're listening, if you're listening out there and you're bored, type click, click, click dot click into your browser URL bar. And you're taken to a page which basically shows you the sorts of things that your browser knows about you, which is just incredible. And I think it's got to the stage where sites that are tracking you can track you across different services. They can even track you when you switch browsers. If you've turned lots of security on, they still can take a good stab at getting who you are. Enough to sort of use that to collect information.
And the interesting thing, which you mentioned about, you know, specifically about Facebook, but when I tried the click, click, click thing, is that it seems to be able to somehow read stuff that you don't actually publish. So as you kind of interact with it, but you haven't clicked send, as it were, it can still process some of that data, not as clearly as if you do publish it, but some of that data, which certainly, you know, was news to me.
Yeah,
because I didn't think that was possible.
Well, I presume that the browser knows as you type into a field, you can have things react, so you can do autocorrect and spelling and all that sort of stuff. So the browser knows that. So all it needs is that information to be sent back. And the idea is that Facebook is doing some of that. And that, I saw a really interesting link to a thread on Reddit, which was all these people saying, I think Facebook is listening into my phone because I make phone calls and then later on I see an advert to do with what I was talking about. And the thread went back and forward, and I know that Facebook was listening by mistake, but it does. As far as I could tell, the idea was it wasn't so much that it was listening in. It just knew so much about you anyway that there was a fairly good chance it was going to get the guesses right for the sorts of things you would be talking about, and hence that it sort of increased the chance of you serendipitously seeing an advert for the medical condition you'd just been chatting to your pal on your phone, that sort of thing. But people were quite convinced in the thread that Facebook was listening to their conversations through the microphone on their phone. As I say, I don't think it was actually happening, but
this is the example of what I mean, that, you know, the whole thing lends itself so much to this kind of paranoia, conspiracy theories and so on, that then kind of, you know, fact gets blended with, you know, with fantasy. And of course, in a sense, that itself can then be abused by people who understand how, you know, how mainstream media works, and then how that gets played out in social media. Because, of course, it's both of those, isn't it? I'm conscious of our time, John. I don't think we're doing very tight.
We'll need to tighten up. So obviously there's links to digital literacy in school and among everybody, but it's going so fast and changing so fast that I don't know how you spend that out. you know, how you get people aware of that and what to do. And I think a couple of things that we picked up which were interesting as pushbacks against this stuff were there was the one I saw was this bloke who'd set up a Twitter bot which tracked Trump and what he said, and it bought automatically stocks and shares based on that. So he thought if things would depress the share price, he bought certain shares and then sold them again quite quickly, because what the president tweets tends to have a very quick effect on the stock exchange and it bounces back. But the nice thing about this one was that he sent all the money he made to that to the American Civil Liberties people and Planned Parenthood, which was quite nice.
And the one I saw, that's Ben Grosser in, I know him on Twitter, but he does a lot of what I guess one would call resistance art, but he is an internet artist and has technical skills. He's done quite a few kind of intervention type things. The latest one is aimed at resisting some of this stuff we've been talking about, and it's called Going Rando. And he set up a thing like a little plugin in a web browser extension that you can use in Facebook, and it allows you to effectively mess up their data gathering. You know, they've got the sort of set of emoticons where you can decide, you know, how you're feeling at the moment, and that will determine whatever it determines. Well, he's found a way in to that so that you instead have this Go Rando kind of little emoticon which has everything, and it messes up their data about, you know, how you're feeling today. And it's a lovely, I think it's a, there's a, we can put the link on the show notes as well. He's done a little video explaining it and so on, and it's a lovely little thing. He does get into trouble with Facebook, and sometimes his things stop working. But it is lovely as this idea of, you know, there are so many different ways in which we can resist some of this. But I guess the main thing about it all is you know, making people aware that it's even happening. And if even those of us who consider ourselves digitally literate and, you know, and who have moved into the internet like me, we're still surprised about some of the things that are being tracked. Imagine, you know, you're kind of, you know, Joe Bloggs, you know, somebody who doesn't have the understanding we have. So the article, I thought it was a lovely quote, and maybe this is a good place to kind of move on to the next thing. The article ends with, "We are the bounty. Our social media feeds, our conversations, our hearts and minds, our votes. Bots influence trending topics, and trending topics have a powerful effect on algorithms. Know how to manipulate information structure, and you can manipulate reality." Yes. Dun, 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 dun. We are in Black Mirror.
Yeah, it sounds very like that. I really do like the Go Rando idea, though, that an individual can still do a wee bit against it. The article was, of course, by Carol Cadwalladr. I don't know how you pronounce her name. We've got a wee note here that she's going to be at the Blue Dot Festival in Jordan Bank in Cheshire, 7th to 9th of July, so hopefully more information. We've got more links than you know what to do with about this topic, and we'll pile them into the show notes, and we'll sort of jump on to the next topic, which is
we'll jump into the next topic where John will explain to all of us what the indie web is.
Yeah, well, I hope the clue's in the title, I think. this idea, indie, independent web, and I think there's probably people who are very purist about this. But I think it's a thing to think about and beware of, and just balance yourself how much you're going to go with this. The idea is that a lot of places that we publish our content or give our content to are corporations, and that we sort of hand over after clicking through some terms and conditions we don't even understand or even pause to look at. We hand over our stuff to these. So the Indie Web, there's a site, indieweb.org, which will pop in the links as well. And it starts off with explaining it's a people-focused alternative to the corporate web. And it's about, I guess, controlling, at least to start with, your own data. So I think it turns out that when people started doing things like the Web 2.0 idea, when people started, individuals started posting to the internet, or even before that, they set up sites themselves, they owned what they put on, and it was probably quite a lot of work. And then along came all these services that made it easy to do things, and they made it easy to do things in the sort of the deal you made with them, even if you didn't know it, was that some of the stuff you gave them belonged to them. They could use your information and all the rest of it in different ways. And the idea with the Indie Web is to sort of push back against that by keeping your content to
And there are some really interesting projects under that heading, aren't there? That, I mean, that's part of what, you know, today, in a sense, we're kind of introducing some things. But, you know, and we want to kind of come back and talk about some of those, some that we might be contributing to, but also, you know, some that we know about, and maybe to talk a little bit about how they may or may not be helpful in the context of education.
Yeah. And I guess the first bit is that if you publish your data to your own site first, at least, before putting it out somewhere else, that means that you've got the sort of copyright and you own it. One of the really interesting things I read a wee while ago was a lawyer had looked at Instagram's terms and conditions and translated it into language for children, which I understood, so I was quite pleased about that. And basically, if you sign up to Instagram, as far as I know, your pictures stay belonging to you, but you give Instagram the right to use them and to rent them out, basically, to other people so that they can use them. You also give them the right to use anything you post there, so any messages or anything else that they can use that. So, and they can also sort of sell that to third parties. Pretty much you'd surrendered every single right you had as soon as you went in there. And I actually really like Instagram. I think it's a nice place for sort of casual messing about and sharing photographs, but it made you just step back a wee bit. Something that you think, that's on my phone, I can knock out a picture. You're telling them where you are, and then you're talking to people and doing all sorts of information you're giving them, and they can pass that on to other people who can use it in various ways. They can also use your images, I guess, and make money out of them or whatever, which I'm not...
Are there any projects that you know of that maybe are somehow kind of the sort of indie web alternatives to it?
To Instagram, no. And I think, I mean, that one of the things I think, I suppose, is it's... technically, I suppose, reasonably easy to post your own text, some of your own images, but once you've got a lot of images, you need something that's scaling to the size of Flickr just to be able to use that amount of information. And when you get onto something like video, which the file sizes are huge and the bandwidth needs to be big, we've really, you know, people use YouTube or Vimeo to publish all their own content there and sign up to their terms and conditions. And I don't know how easy it would be to get your control back from that. But the idea with the Indie Web is that everything goes to your own place first, and they can be sent out to other services. Now, a lot of people do this already if you have a blog set up, and it would automatically send a tweet to Twitter. So the initial place it starts is yours. And certainly in my blog, I have a thing set up called Web Mentions, which I can't really say I understand fully, but I installed a few plugins. And what happens now is when I post a link to automatically a link to a post on my blog, then anybody that replies to that or likes that on Twitter, that gets fed back to my blog as a comment by this Bridgy service. So that sort of keeps the stuff, I guess with me, it allows me to use my own site to engage with other people.
So that's one element of it, isn't it? Yeah. The kind of having your own domain and then setting things up so that you keep at the very least a copy of your data. The other element of it, I guess, it's the wider thing of, you know, can you find alternatives? I guess, like, you know, can you find alternatives? Like I was just asking about Instagram, you know, are there alternatives to the sort of Instagram idea? Or like, you know, we often talk about alternatives to Twitter that keep emerging. Some of those are private, some of those are kind of, you know, independent and open source. And I guess that would also fall under this heading of the independent web, would it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think we can come back to a few different services. There's some really interesting ones sort of floating up. There's one, the microblog, which is bubbling to the top. Is it Mastodon? Is that?
That's
Mastodon, which is another Twittery thing. And I think we could probably dig into those in other shows at some point. But we probably should just roll right on. We'll put a couple of links to the indie web stuff up in the show notes. And we'll move on to the last section. And we're taking a first look at digital mindfulness. Now, Mariana, you've got a background as a psychologist in, I suppose, non-digital mindfulness, I think, yeah?
I do. And as I was thinking about, you know, our idea today was to try and introduce some of these headings that we're going to be coming back to, because, you know, it is something that, you know, I do a lot, and there are lots of different approaches and techniques and that we can, you know, use. But as I was looking through how to introduce it, I came across this quote by Marshall McLuhan. And he asked, how are we to get out of the maelstrom created by our own ingenuity? And I thought, what a lovely thing, because in a sense, you know, the whole idea of digital mindfulness is really about, you know, how do we find that sort of, you know, still point, you know, in the maelstrom of information and Twitters and domains and all of the things that we've been talking about, you know, the sort of overflow of data. And I love this image of the maelstrom and then finding, you know, the eye of the storm kind of thing. So, and within, you know, my kind of background around it, as and we'll be coming back, you know, to it, is that the whole idea of digital mindfulness, or I guess being intentional with technology, being more aware about, you know, how we use it and the relationship that we have to it. I set up this thing called the Still Web, which I call a digital contemplation studio, where we do lots of activities and so on to really to help people understand a little bit more about what it means to relate to technology in a more mindful way. Really, I guess, under the heading of mindfulness, what, you know, one often talks about is really good old-fashioned attention and intention. So, you know, the whole thing about to what extent are we aware of, you know, our habits and our addictions and, you know, the things that we are unconscious about when we are relating to technology day to day. I was talking to one of my students yesterday, and he was confessing to a resistance to technology. And we talked about this, and I told him about this book that I thought he should read, which is called In Real Life. And I have now forgotten the author, but the book is lovely because this guy says, you know, we are, whether we like it or not, we are in a relationship with technology. The relationship might be crap, but that's your responsibility. And I said to him, you know, I kind of suits this occasion. You know, you're clearly not happy in the context of how you're interacting with you know, when we say technology, it's such a kind of, you know, huge, all-encompassing word, you know, it's how we use all these different elements. But I said to him, you know, perhaps it would be a good idea that, you know, to think about how you could establish a better relationship with technology.
And
I guess this is what we think we're thinking about talking about around you know, digital mindfulness.
It's almost the other side of the coin to the stuff that we're talking about to start with. You know, understanding how, or getting an idea of how this data and how it's affecting us works, and understanding the internet well enough to, you know, avoid the pitfalls of silos, or at least understand what's happening when you do it is a sort of the technical side. And this other side is more, I guess, what you do and how that affects the same sort of thing. We're obviously talking about, both of us like technology, but we've been talking quite a lot about some of the adverse effects of it, and that there seems to be two ways to resist that, and one is to understand the actual technology a wee bit better, but the other is to understand our reaction to it better.
The whole,
I'm sure we'll come back to the psychology of likes at some point, you know, the endorphin, the micro endorphin hits and bits and pieces like that.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so well, that's three sections. I don't think we divided them very equally today.
No, we haven't.
We have run to 36 minutes, which by my book is pretty much like 30, if you round down quite a lot. And we're just kind of going to wrap up now, and we have got one more link, and one of the things both Marianne and I are interested in is open education. And there's a big international conference every year, the Open Education Conference. And the one this year, of course, is OER17. And at the moment, there's going to be a webinar which is giving a sort of preview of that, which if you're interested in these things and not trapped at work, you can go and see. It's online. It's on Thursday, 9th of March at 12:30 to 1:30. The link is far too long to put in a podcast, but we'll put it in the show notes as a footer. And it looks like from the Josie Fraser is involved in this. And Josie is one of these people who's been affected from primary school right through to higher ed. I think she's working at least in part for Wikimedia at the moment. She has worked for, I think it was Leicester City Council, in doing digital education and internet safety, as a all-round very clever person. So I think that would be good to listen to if you can pay attention. She's also with Alex Tarkowski, who's the other person that's chairing the conference, the Open EOA Carters. He's from Poland. So if you've got time in the middle of the day, you could see that. But it will be recorded, I think, so you should be able to watch the recording later on. That looks like something good if you're interested in open education in its widest sense. I'd say most of it tends to come from higher ed, but as a primary school teacher, I've always found things to be interesting to me in open education and the people that are talking about it. So,
and can we say hello and thank you to Caroline Braley on Twitter? She sent a little tweet. She's clearly been listening. So and she says, episode, you know, she sent the link of the program and says it is different but very interesting. So thank you for that.
Yeah, Caroline's a long-term EduTalk listener from the fringes of Great Britain, I would say.
well, that's lovely, isn't it?
Way up in the Shetlands.
We are glad that you're enjoying it.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll just say good night. This is the first time we've done this. Felt okay to me, Mariana, so we'll see. It should be online in a day or two once I get it edited and stuck up on EduTalk. So I'm going to hang up now. So good night, folks.
Good night.